Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. America, from border to border, coast to coast, and all the ships at sea. Streaming live from the County of Kings, Brooklyn, New York City, on the Heritage Radio Network. Are you ready for the fastest half hour on the internet today? It's the Mike and Judy Show, spanning the globe for high-minded hijinks and lowbrow kicks to bring you the best in sex, drugs, rock and roll, and nuclear fission. They're too bad for radio and too good-looking for television. And now, here they are, the Nichols and May of the Now Generation, your hosts, Mike Edison and Judy McGuire.
Hello.
Hi, Judy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm feeling really good today.
Yes, you're a little drunk and hungover.
It's awesome, but go ahead. Just out me to our vast radio audience.
I can't because I will get in deep trouble if I out you because
we're not talking about your drinking problem. And your problem is you don't drink enough in the shower before you get to the show.
I can't drink in the shower. We have two fantastic guests today, and one of them is an old friend of mine, Michael Gonzalez, who's a writer, and he explained my problem. I'm Irish. I don't like to waste liquor, and you are going to water down your beer if you drink it in the shower.
It's a matter of technique. It's just technique. It's not rocket science. Snorting cocaine in the shower, that's rocket science, and I can explain how to do that perhaps at a later show. But drinking beer in the shower, it's not that difficult. Hot water on the back, cold beer in front of you. It's not complex.
You have one of those.
It's like the bedrock of multitasking, too. You know, it's an important sort of practice to get
used to. It is the solution to all of life's problems.
I'm
being
peer pressured into drinking beer in the shower. I'm a girl. I'm supposed to drink like a glass of white wine in the bath.
That's okay. I'm okay with the champagne in the bubble bath, but this is a different. This is a different lifestyle component.
All right. Well, I had one beer and. I guess that because I didn't have breakfast, I'm kind of wasted from my one beer.
Okay, McGuire, who are our guests today?
Our guests are, like I mentioned before, Michael A. Gonzalez, who is a great writer, a good friend, and really funny. He's a cultural critic, I'm reading on his bio, sorry. He's written cover stories for Wax Poetic, Vibe, Stop Smiling, and XXL, and he currently blogs at blackadelicpop.blogspot.com, and he has...
He's the Jackie Robinson of the Mike and Judy Show.
He is our first black guest, which is really embarrassing.
That says a lot. I mean, how many years have you guys been on the show?
I'm thoroughly embarrassed.
Today's show is really about years ago in Bushwick. I'm Bushwick. You
fucking
think we could
Bushwick.
Round
today's show is really about my liberal guilt.
Puerto Ricans?
But wait, I think we might have. I don't know. But our other guest is a new friend to the Mike and Judy
White
Show.
Dude.
Who is Mike? Maxwell
Boring.
Tremblay. He writes for Maximum Rock and Roll and plays drums in the band Sleepies, and he's getting his PhD, which makes him smarter than any of us.
And he writes for Maximum Rock and Roll, which makes him smarter than any of us.
I think the jury's still out on that one, to be perfectly honest.
He's a co-author of a book that I just started reading the other day called White Riot, Punk Rocks and the Politics of Race, which I'm enjoying because at first I was a little scared off thinking it was a little
hypoallergenic? Hyperacademic.
I worked in academia for a while, and that's what made me not want to get my PhD, because we were doing all these cool studies, and then we were writing stories that nobody could read. But this is a great book. It has interviews with anti-academics, anti-intellectuals.
Well, and that's sort of by design, in the sense that we are both academics that are kind of anti-academics to a certain extent. We try to sort of, we have to have the sort of good academic essays in there to sort of give it that sheen of scholarliness.
And then you have dumbasses like Ian Stewart from Screwdriver, who... sadly passed.
I know.
Passed.
Good riddance. Yeah, good
fucking
riddance.
Racist. I mean, the question, though, is you take something like punk rock, which should resist all attempts to put it in an academic context, and here you are, slapping this book learning on something that should be just intuitive.
I don't know. I mean, Michael was just on a panel. Was it last week?
Yeah, last Saturday.
Tell us a little bit about the panel, because it was really interesting.
It was basically about English fanzines in the 80s, but you know, I was there because I started out writing in punk fanzines, but I used to write about hip hop and punk fanzines. So basically, they pulled me in as the Jackie Robinson of the panel to talk about, you know, how hip hop and punk were kind of together at one time, and at least in New York. I can't speak for any place else.
In DC too. I mean, those are the two places I was, and me and my friend Julie, I had a mohawk, she had spikes. We went to go see like breakdancing contests and Public Enemy.
Oh yeah, I mean, I was always at the Grandmaster Flash gigs. I saw the Soul Sonic Force. I don't know how many times.
And Flash opened for the Clash.
Yeah,
one time. I also saw Curtis Blow get booed off the stage opening for the Clash, which was just fucking heartbreaking.
Well, I mean, when the Clash played at Bonds, they played one night. They were really into hip hop because the whole, you know, English punk scene had, you know, the reggae influence, which also influenced hip hop, and they got Grandmaster Flash to open for them at Bonds International, and they were booed off the stage as well.
Yeah, well, the Clash were hip. I mean, they also, aside from the hip hop artists, they're into black R&B artists that a lot of punk rockers probably, you know, weren't that hip to. Lee Dorsey they loved. But I heard Bo Diddley got booed off the stage in front of them, I think at the Palladium. I mean, they were always having these cool acts, the kind of people Rolling Stones were more likely to have to show their debt to, you know, black R&B artists that the Clash would have. And idiot, you know, white punk rock kids just didn't fucking get it. And is that cool to?
Well, it's the
fucking Bo Diddley off the stage. I mean, what the fuck is wrong with these kids?
Well, it shows, I think, first of all, that the Clash were always maybe smarter than their fan base, I think, which is probably still true of a lot of punk rock.
A fan. I'm okay, never mind.
or smarter than, say, the sort of vast kind of knee jerk white kid majority of their fan base.
I read your Joe Strummer interview. It was pretty good for a girl.
Whoa. some punk fanzine actually wrote that. Like, it was pretty good for a girl.
Oh, really?
You know, I think, you know, I mean, gender, we're talking about race and punk rock, but I mean, gender and punk rock too. I mean, it has been straight white dudes.
Absolutely.
I mean, predominantly.
Yeah. Well, and but you do get these sort of interesting moments, things like Riot Girl and things like some of the zine culture in the late 90s that actually do try to address that issue in a very punk rock language, at least. You have, you know, Kathleen Hanna going "suck my left one," or the band Los Crudos saying "we're that spick band," trying to actually call out these punk kids for being just primarily kind of white and middle class and male, even.
What was the okay, forgive me because I can't remember because I had a beer, but there was an essay in the book written by somebody who felt like punk rock was a completely white construct that owed no debt to like black rock and roll.
Well, that was one of the white supremacists.
Okay, that was my skimming section.
I should say we do have a section in the book on white power because we feel like it's important to actually look at how these kids work out their own kind of hideous and vile discourse. But that's the sort of most extreme example of that, where it's really somebody who has made this political commitment to white supremacy and then trying to tell this whole alternate history that's basically a lie of how rock and roll is an entirely white musical phenomenon, and they do that in this crazy way where they point to like church music in the South and like Appalachian folk songs and all this kind of shit. It's absolutely batty.
But don't forget, Johnny Ramone had said when he started the band that he wanted to create a music that was without blues. Right?
That's what he said, which is
ridiculous, because if you listen to all the girl band influences and all this sort of like latent R&B stuff that was sort of happening, which obviously came, you know, from Motown and black girl groups that they were into, but he really wanted to reduce it. It does not swing. It does not shake with the dotted eighth note the way the Rolling Stones do. It is without blues. Sort of, kind of. I mean, it's a very white music what the Ramones do.
Except when Phil Spector was producing them, right?
Yeah.
And pulling guns on them. That was the best story.
That's a very underrated record. I like that record. The Phil Spector Ramones record.
End of the Century?
Yeah, yeah.
I will go out on a limb and say that's my favorite Ramones record.
Wow.
I think people will probably like.
Okay, this is why you're getting you're getting a PhD in punk rock.
That is not the best Ramones record. Michael, what's the best Ramones record?
I was never really into the Ramones, but I did live in the building with one of them. I can't remember which one. But somewhere on
skinny guy,
Chelsea.
Long black hair.
Yeah. Really tall, but he was like 6 foot.
Oh yeah, I know that guy. The one with the leather jacket. Well, you know, I mean, if punk rock's, you know, a white construct, I mean, can white boys play the blues?
Sometimes.
Occasionally. I don't know.
English. They got to be English.
You think so? What about
really?
What about that sexy Charlie Sexton?
I don't really know a lot about Charlie Sexton.
And what about the Clash playing reggae music? Which I know you claim to hate reggae music,
but
you love the Clash. Explain.
It's the bass line. It's the bass line.
Sexy bass line.
It's heavy shit.
To me, reggae is like hippie music. I swear, High Times ruined my life. High Times, like, put me off reggae music.
Was it High Times or Frat Boys ruining reggae for you, though?
Well, Frat Boys also.
Okay.
It's more the crap. I also don't like really slow music. I like things that are, like, more poppy. I like songs with words. I mean, reggae has words, but that's why I don't like jazz.
Who the fuck can understand those people?
The Clash reggae stuff is kind of their weakest link for me.
I like their rub-a-dub stuff. I like it when they're doing,
I like Police and Thieves, but they, you know, they sped it up a little.
I mean, the Junior Mervyn version is like, it's wonderful. To me, that's rhythm and blues. You know, when I hear, you know, the reggae from that period, from the 70s, like Junior Mervyn stuff, to me, it's closer to R&B than that hippie shit, which I agree with you. I don't want to hear this, like, loopy, jammy, hacky sack, frisbee tossing, smoke doobies in the park reggae. I'm not into that shit. I'm one of the guys. I mean, Bob Marley was a soul man. You know, Peter Tosh, soul man. Toots of the Maytals, that is some powerful shit. We're going to re-educate you, McGuire.
You're going to have to reprogram me.
We're going to go back in time and make you and take away that whole High Times chapter of our life.
No, here's the thing. There's some music that goes well with certain drugs. Reggae goes really good with pot smoking. I don't smoke pot. I don't enjoy being altered in that way. So it's not really my speed. It's not my jam, man. How's that?
All right.
Middle-aged lady.
Yeah. So Maximum Rock and Roll is still running. It's still on the newsstands. It's still happening.
Yeah.
At Filthy Inky Sammy's dot.
Yes. After everybody went glossy, they still have the stuff that gets newsprint all over your hands and stuff.
I love Maximum Rock and Roll.
Yeah, I haven't read it in a while.
Middle-aged ladies don't.
reading Oprah magazine and more.
They don't cover a lot of funk records, really. Yeah. O magazine.
No, well, you're talking about fan. I think Maximum Rock and Roll certainly did more, you know, in its heyday to spread the word, you know, the scene reports and whatnot.
Oh, yeah.
And there was like a global community, a national community.
Yeah, pre-internet.
Before the internet, this is how we communicated. And boy, I remember when my record was first reviewed in Maxim Rock and Roll. It was a thrill.
Did they like it?
They did, actually. Later, other records, they didn't, not so much. The first one they liked a lot. But, you know, I knew that, like, you know, it was being seen, like, you know, by kids in Nevada, by kids in San Diego, you know, Flipside, Two Another Fanzine, which was out of San Diego, right?
Fanzines
were like, that was the thing.
Well, and it they have this sort of international reach, and especially, I mean, I've gotten bad reviews from MRR before, and it sort of, it hurts a little bit more because it is that kind of, like, international stage on some level, right? I mean,
so how does MRR function? I mean, you write from occasionally, it's still like that cooperative,
yeah,
sort of I mean, it's really, it's San Francisco, it's really where hippies meet punks,
right. And really, I mean, somebody has to do a book about this, I think, or something like that, but I really think that it is that kind of San Francisco hippie legacy that turns punk rock from the sort of symbolic playground it once was into this sort of hardened, crusty leftist progressivism. And MRR basically functions as, you know, it has two coordinators who don't get paid, but they get to live in the house and do really all of the copy editing. I don't know how they do it. They must work like...
Is it still so jam-packed?
It is. And it's still, you know, it's still half ads, which is how they support themselves, I guess.
But hey, they get advertising. That's better
than... Maybe we should put an ad for the Mike and Judy show on Maximum Rock and Roll.
I'm up for that.
It's not a bad idea.
I think we should.
And they actually have a weekly radio show, too, the Maximum Rock and Roll podcast, which is really good.
And, you know, they were definitely ahead of their time. I mean, just the outreach of the whole magazine and the way it functioned.
It took them a while to figure out the internet, though. This big, scary thing
called
the internet.
I mean, them and Rolling Stone and Spin, too. They're so behind the times on the internet. Like, Rolling Stone just got their shit together online pretty recently. Spin is just getting it.
They're just basically turning into an internet company. They're decreasing their frequency. They're going bi-monthly.
Spin?
Yeah, and they're trying to, you know, up their internet presence. I mean, there's a story about it in the New York Times this week. Okay. They laid off some staff. They had some staff changes.
That's stuff they should have been doing, like, 5 years ago.
You had to see this shit coming. I mean, how do you not see this happening?
New York Magazine did a great job of integrating the two.
You know, and now everybody's like running around saying, I mean, Vice did a great job. Yep. I mean, they knew they were, you know, it's going
to
get started.
Vice was like, I mean, that guy Gavin was smart enough to hire people a lot younger than him. And it's true. I mean,
no, it's old people.
Well, I will say
one thing,
you know, if you go to Google Books, I'm sorry. If you go to Google Books, you can find all the old Spin magazines.
Yeah.
From the first issue till like 2 years ago.
Oh, that's cool.
And yeah, Spin was great when it started. I mean, they did real journalism. I mean, they were great stories.
Yeah, journalism. Legs McNeil talking about screwing Sinead O'Connor. Yeah, well, the cover story. Well, that was like, what?
They did some good
stories. Well, was she bald at the time?
Yeah, she was.
See, that's a story.
Well, I think we're going to take a break, and we're going to go out with the Slits. Doing a Marvin Gaye song.
Awesome.
Oh, cool.
Can you dig it? The Mike and Judy Show, streaming live from Roberta's here in Bushwick, Brooklyn, the County of Kings, brought to you by the Heritage Radio Network. This is Mike Edison with Judy McGuire. How's it going, Judy?
I love that song.
That was not Gladys Knight.
What?
Well, what do you think is the best version of Heard It Through the Grapevine? Michael, what do you think?
I think Marvin's is the best version.
Yeah, I like the Gladys Knight version.
I didn't like Gladys until she left Motown. Like, I liked Gladys when she hooked up with Curtis Mayfield.
Yeah, right? Right? That's cool. And the Pips?
And the Pips. And the Claudine soundtrack.
All right. So we were talking about, before we left, we were talking about publishing and journalism and the internet.
And how we used to be able to make a living writing about music.
I know.
Michael, you still can, though.
Yeah, barely. I mean, you know, I write for a bunch of websites. I do write a lot of, you know, free stuff, or as my friend Amy Linden likes to say, on spec. But, you know, but I still write for music magazines. I still write for Wax Poetics, where I have, you know, which is one of my favorite music
magazines. Love Wax Poetics. Wax Poetics is fantastic.
You know, I mean, like, the amount of knowledge that you can get from one issue of Wax Poetics is pretty cool. You know, and I just did a cover story for them on Nina Simone. But oh, I did it 9 months ago, and I'm still waiting for my check. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, but Wax Poetics, I mean, it's a labor of love. I mean, it's got to be.
A labor of love.
I mean, I know. Yeah.
It'd be nice to pay your phone bill so you can get a damn cell phone. I mean,
well, hey, you got to keep the lights on. We're all writers, and we've been crushed by this concept that content should be free.
Right.
Yeah.
It's so depressing.
And apparently not. I mean, you know, it costs money to keep a news desk in Kabul, you know, let alone Washington, let alone have someone qualified to write about punk rock in New York City.
I mean, especially, I mean, I'm sort of coming at it from a different angle just because I always wrote for free for Maximum Rock and Roll just because that was sort of their model, at least. But that was also the kind of labor of love thing. I can't imagine, I mean, but having a whole industry take that model seems very suspect to me.
It's very sad.
Well, yeah. The industry is crashing. Speaking of the model of doing things for free and Maximum Rock and Roll, have you guys been downtown? Have you visited the protests? Are you guys with the protesters? Are you part of the 99%?
Yeah, I marched with them yesterday and on last Wednesday. I actually got to sort of see their whole infrastructural setup they have right now. It's really, really quite something. It's like something out of Thunderdome.
Can you explain it to us? Because no one else seems to be able to.
Okay.
Yeah, the three old people, we haven't been down there.
Like, I don't go to protests.
I don't know if there's a toilet for me, so like...
They do have a nice sort of gray water system, if that's your thing. Ew, I know. It is kind of gross.
Well, so what is going on? It just seems like a lot of left-wing sludge, I think, that needs to be, that needs to be more defined. People don't really understand what they're about.
Well, I think there's sort of a few registers at which it's working. One is to say that, you know, yeah, there's a sort of dirty, crusty kids down there who can, you know, who don't have pulls on their lives that can keep them down there on the regular, say. But then I think the past week, at least, it's been more about just, you know, different kinds of people have been shit on saying, like, there's something fundamentally wrong with our system of values in this country, you know?
It's true.
I absolutely concur with that.
I agree, too.
You know, I think it's powerful when labor unions come down and march, you know, with the crusties. I mean, that was always the thing with Maxim Rock and Roll. And you remember this, Judy, when we were, you know, coming up in the punk rock world, we were hanging out with Reagan Youth, and there were a lot of people who felt entitled and they should be, you know, get handed out food. And when I was in San Francisco, you know, people cooking lentils in the parking lot, and not as an alternative or because they couldn't afford to do it, but because it was just a sort of protest against materialism. It was very idealistic, actually. Yeah. I mean, I remember someone like trying to start a fight with me because I confessed that I owned a color TV. I was like, fuck you. Of course I own a color TV. What's wrong with you?
Wow. That's so bougie of you, Mike.
Yeah, seriously. Well, I mean,
did it have a remote control and everything?
probably not back then.
So what else have you been writing, Michael? You write crime stuff too, right?
Yeah. I've been writing a lot of crime fiction short stories. I came into writing because when I was a kid, I saw The French Connection, and that movie changed my life.
Awesome.
And I always wanted to write crime fiction, you know, and when I started writing professionally, I started writing music stuff, music journalism, and working for Vibe and The Source. But in the last couple of years, I've started working on a crime novel that I'm working on, and I've been writing for all these different websites, writing short stories for Beat to a Pulp. There's another magazine called Needle, which comes out. They published one of my short stories last year.
And RKB loves your stuff. Are you getting published in Best Sex Writing?
Well, that's the erotica writing that I do.
Yeah, he's also a dirty bird.
He's a pornographer.
No, erotica.
Erotica. One man's pornography.
Oh, we should do the angel dust survey.
Okay, quick straw poll. If you guys smoked any angel dust?
Ever.
Not lately.
No.
I smoked angel dust once.
Okay, yeah. You're in.
Now we're down to two guests.
You're
total
in.
Total of the Mike and Judy show who have never tried angel dust.
You know, the demographics of the show are we've had more angel dust smokers than we've had people of color or gay people.
But can I say one thing? That's the worst drug on the planet.
Oh, yeah, we all agree.
It's fucked up shit. Some fucked up shit. And James Brown discovered it when he was like 60, right?
See what happened to him.
I know. Yeah, that worked. I never understood that. It's like, okay, James, you're 60, get into crack. I get it. There's some pleasurable.
I don't really
get the getting into crack
when you're over 60.
Well,
either.
It's pleasurable. There's an obvious benefit to smoking crack.
Angel
it makes
dust
you feel
is
good.
Just hell.
As drugs should make you feel good. That's why, it's presumably, why we fucking take them, because recreational drugs, right? Because they make you feel fucking good. You smoke some crack, you get high. You take PCP, you want to empty your fucking gun into your wife's car. It's not good. There's no upside to this.
My brother's girlfriend, this was like in the 80s, and they used to do this. She was from DC. They used to do a thing in DC called Love Boat.
Oh, yeah.
And where they would like, it was like, I don't know, angel dust dipped in embalming fluid
it was horrible.
And I smoked this stuff by accident because she's.
Ain't that the way it always happens, though?
It was like, I felt like I was on a roller coaster that just kept going down.
That actually sounds pretty cool. So what was the recipe again? It was angel dust, embalming fluid.
But you had to like roll it and then dip it in the embalming fluid. Yeah. It was very complex.
DC had a whole bunch of really interesting.
You're talking to a guy who can snort cocaine in the shower. Yeah. It's not too complex for me.
You got to teach me that one.
What you do is, first of all, you need to keep the moisture. Okay.
Do I have to be the voice of reason again? Okay. I'm always the mom. Like when
you need a fulcrum for the straw. It's sort of like Archimedes' lever kind of, and the thing to protect the. It's complex.
We're talking about
it's advanced, very 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 advanced and awesome. So I mean, selling crime writing. I mean, that's like the old. That's as old school as it gets. That's pulp. That is pulp fiction.
Yeah,
that's the right definition of it.
There seems to be a little resurgence in terms of. I mean, there's a website called Mahalan Books. Mahalan is. Put out through Little Brown, Michael Peach's publishing company. And there's a lot of crime fiction that's been coming out. I guess, you know, it's kind of sad, but as much as I like Pulp Fiction, Tarantino kind of revised this whole, you know, in the 90s, kind of revised this whole pulp thing. And there's great writers coming out of England. One of my favorite writers is Irish, actually, Kim Bruin, who wrote a book called The Guards, and he's written many books. Jason Starr is another writer that I love.
You know, sticking to our original topic of race and punk rock and whatever, but speaking of crime, there have been great black crime writers. Has there ever been a great black pornographer?
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, look, there was a a magazine called Players that used to come out in the 70s. And there were a lot of writers, I'm sure, who wrote for Players. Now, I didn't really read Players. I did look at the pictures.
Who does?
You didn't read the article?
No.
I mean, that's why every guy...
But there were a lot of articles in it, you know? So I'm sure there was some... I mean, okay, Steve Cannon wrote a great pornography novel that our mutual friend Darius James turned me on to. It's called something like Bang Groove Jive Around or something like that.
Yeah, no white person could have written that.
Well, Olympia Press put it out in the late 60s. And I think Olympia was, what, with Evergreen or part of Evergreen? That Olympia was erotica.
Who's the guy who started Olympia? Got in all that trouble.
Out of Paris, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Alzheimer's moment here.
Yeah, I'm old too.
One beer and
one old, and a half beer.
I think I'm off the reservation, Judy, McGuire.
By like 6 months.
Yeah, whatever.
Well, it counts, though. Every second counts.
Well, you know, speaking of pornography and race, you know, Hugh Hefner would like to claim, you know, that he, you know, was the answer to the whole civil rights movement.
Oh, that documentary was such a blowjob to him.
Seriously, you know my feelings on Hefner.
He helped feminism.
He invented it by putting rabbit's ears on their head and putting bunny tails on them. That's how he freed women.
He let them keep their tips.
I mean, you really can't, you know, beat Hefner on a few things. I mean, he was hiring black comedians, Dick Gregory, one of the first, when he couldn't get a gig anywhere else. And Alex Haley was a writer and did many interviews. And but seriously, even when he started covering jazz, I mean, he's so fucking white, that Hefner guy, right? Even when he was covering jazz, he was still writing about the Dorsey brothers after Thelonious Monk was on the cover of Time.
I have to say one thing. My favorite out of in Playboy was Leroy Neiman. Leroy Neiman doing those Miles Davis paintings.
I love that stuff. I'm with Michael on this, because Leroy Neiman, when he started, it was... You know, his approach, it was using illustration as fine art. That was the concept. Now it's become like this cliche, these Leroy Neiman sports things that he does. You see blasted all over Sports Illustrated and in shopping malls. But at the beginning, when he was illustrating James Bond, I mean, people weren't doing illustrations, painterly illustrations as art. And that's Art Paul, the art director of Playboy, who really, you know, found that thing. It was the fine art movement. It was sort of like breaking down. You know, it's a real breaking down of like lowbrow versus highbrow culture, and considering comics and illustration as, you know, the same league as fine art.
Now nobody pays for anything.
Sucks.
Well, I know in the last couple of years, Playboy has been using a comic book artist that I really love to do paintings for them, this guy named Kent Williams. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Kent started off, you know, as Marvel DC guy, and now he's like a big fine artist who kind of goes between both worlds. And, you know, he's doing a bunch of Playboy illustrations.
Well, you're in the comic book world as well.
Oh, my God, yes.
I know a lot about comics, but I don't write comics. I've never written comics.
He's an avid consumer of them, though.
Dork.
Especially Howard Chaykin.
Dork, now there's down the comic book world. I mean,
shut up. I love him.
Another place where straight white dudes kind of dominate, right?
Well,
yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I mean, you can especially see that at the sort of weird knee-jerk fan outrage when, like, Donald Glover from Community tweeted, like, as a joke that he might want to try out for Spider-Man, and everybody went up in arms, like, oh, you can't have a black Spider-Man or something like that. It's very bizarre.
Well, our friend wrote Black Captain America.
Oh, really?
Well, I do have to say one thing on both sides. There are a lot of black punk fans and a lot of black comic book fans. If you go to a comic book convention or a comic book store on Wednesday, which I never do.
How about chicks,
I went with you on a Wednesday to Forbidden Planet once, and you bought me a copy of Fanboy.
Oh,
it was
that the Hernandez brothers?
No, it was some other dorksicle.
Right. It was Sergio Angeles.
But yeah, that is a unifier. It's like the guys who are socially awkward, who stand 6 inches from the wall, so you can't. They don't know how to browse correctly. Fanboys. That's
well, I always tried to be a fanboy and a player, so you know.
Hey, you know,
let the lady slide in front of you.
No, I'm with that. You got to be a fan. I hate people who are too jaded to be enthusiastic, and that sucks. And that's punk rock, right?
Well, and it really is. Especially, I think you can see how, unfortunately, the way that the decline of, say, the comics industry right now really has a lot to do with, I think, the sort of cynical, like, oh, I can't love anything just to love it. But, you know, I can't have that kind of engagement with something anymore. I need things to be curated for me or something like that.
Curated. I hate that word.
I hate that word. It's terrible.
you picked some stuff out.
No, but there is something really cool about, you know, the kid who either, you know, just goes to the record store and buys every punk record that he sees, or buys every new comic book that came out that day, that we're kind of losing, I think.
Yeah, okay, I hate to be like the total grandma, but that's really what the internet has screwed up. Like, when we were young, we had to really search for coolness. Now you could just, like, somebody can tell you about a cool website and they'll tell you what to listen to, because it's cool.
Why is that a bad thing?
Because it used to be hard to be cool. And that was better.
There
that
used to be
cooler.
Fewer of us.
That's right. There's too many. It's
and now everybody's got an internet radio show. So, Michael, tell us, tell our vast listening audience where they can find you and where they can find more about your work.
Recently, I just did a big piece on the 15th anniversary of the Basquiat movie that is in a magazine called Juicy. And despite the title, it's not a porno magazine. It is
it's for ladies, right?
It's a gossip magazine. It's kind of like a black version of Star or Inquirer, but they let me write these really cool back in the day stories because I'm 1,000 years old. So,
all right. Well,
and
fine.
Max, where can we find your book? Anywhere, right?
It's in stores. I've heard people see it as far as Australia and Istanbul.
Repeat the title for us. So
White Riot, Punk Rock, and the Politics of Race from Verso.
And I bet it can be found on Amazon.com.
It can be.
That filthy institution.
But you should buy it from an independent bookstore like Word in Greenpoint.
For instance.
Or St. Mark's, especially,
St. Mark's.
Who are having a hard time with their rent lately. So
That's right. So, once again, from Roberta's here on the Heritage Radio Network, it's the Mike and Judy Show, supporting punk rock and independent booksellers across America. We'll see you guys next week.
Listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. Heritage Meat Shop has just opened in the Essex Street Market. Open from 9 to 7 Monday through Saturday and 10 to 6 on Sundays, the Heritage Meat Shop supports independent family farms and animal welfare approved and certified humane raising standards. Most importantly, they offer a wide variety of heritage breeds. So stop by, get a sandwich, try the charcuterie, the Heritage Meat Shop at the Essex Street Market.